mother's home. May the Lord show you kindness as you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband. Then she kissed them goodbye and they wept aloud and said to her, we will go back with you to your people. But Naomi said, return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters. It's more bitter for me than for you because the Lord's hand has turned against me. As we read through the book of Ruth, we're going to see God working through providence. We're not going to see any big supernatural miracles. We're not going to see any big speeches from God. We are going to see God working through providence, through the circumstances of life, through the people who honor his name. We are told that the Lord caused the famine to end. The famine that drove them from their homeland and caused them to go and settle in Moab, the Lord caused the famine to end. And so Naomi and her daughters return. And I need to pause here and point out that these women are very vulnerable. These women are in a very vulnerable situation. They are widows living in a patriarchal society. There is no social security, there's no welfare. For these women, their security, their provision came from the men in their lives. The fathers, the husbands, the sons. These people are very vulnerable. They're going back to a very vulnerable situation. And what's more, for Orpah and Ruth, they are picking up and moving to a foreign land. They do not know how they are going to be treated in that land. They're going to be resident aliens, even more vulnerable to what is happening to them. You can hear it again and again as Naomi speaks, not just in this passage, through the whole book. Naomi's great concern is that there is no husband and there is no son to provide for her and her daughters. That is Naomi's great concern. The first words that come out of Naomi's mouth in this book is a blessing in the name of Yahweh. She is blessing her daughters-in-law in the name of the God of Israel, and she's urging them to go home. Go back. She's praying that they would go home, go back to their Moabite households, and that God would bless them with a husband. And this is not just about romance. This is about provision, present provision, future provision. This is about social recognition. What hope would these women, these young women, have if they came with Naomi? Who is going to look after them in their future? When her daughters resist, Naomi becomes insistent. You have no future with me. Maybe she's worried about carrying the dead weight of two single women, two single foreign women. But verse 11 to 14, it centers on the idea of husbands and sons. This is a crisis. Not just grief for losing a loved one, I'm sure there was that as well, but the loss of provision and the loss of a future. And it's a crisis of faith. This is a crisis of faith. It is more bitter for me than for you because the Lord's hand has turned against me. Four verses earlier, she has blessed these daughter-in-law in the name of Yahweh. And now she says, Yahweh has turned his hand against me. Don't come with me. Don't stick with me. Don't throw in your lot with me because the Lord's hand has turned against me. So let me ask, is that a cry of faith? Is that a cry of faith? I think so. She places her troubles squarely at the feet of God. We see God's hand in the end of the famine, but also in the death of her men. Now, that doesn't mean it's punishment. It means that God allowed it. Sometimes God's providence to us is bitter, But look at what she is not saying. She is not saying God is out of control and he is powerless to stop this bad thing that happened to me. She is not saying that God is powerless. She is not saying that God is absent. She is not saying that God allowed it, therefore it must be good. She places God squarely in the middle of her pain and her grief and her fear for the future. She has a place for tragedy and hardship in her faith. And this is where we get to see the ray of light shining through chapter 1. Look at verse 14 with me. At this, they wept aloud again, and then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. "Look," said Naomi, "your sister-in-law is going back to her people and to her gods. Go back with her." But Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me." When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. Orpah listens to Naomi's bleak assessment. What is the future going to look like if I stick with Naomi? And she returns home. She returns back to what is safe, back to what is known, back where she grew up. And we won't hear about Orpah again. Orpah exits stage left from the story, but Ruth stays. Ruth stays. She clearly loves her mother-in-law. Her time of living in Ruth's household has clearly been a blessing to her, and she loves her mother-in-law, and she's not put off by Naomi's bitterness. She's not put off by Naomi's bitterness or her bleak assessment. But there's something even more here. There's something deeper here than just her affection for her mother-in-law. Notice verse 15. Go back. Your sister-in-law is going back to her people and to her gods. Orpah is returning to an old identity. I take it that while they were living in Elimelech's household, they followed Yahweh. They were faithful to him and they kept the Israelite ways even though they were living in a foreign land. Orpah is returning back to who she was, back to an old identity, worshipping a different God. And yet Ruth is committing herself to this identity. My people will be your people. Not my birth certificate. It doesn't matter that it says Moabite written on my birth certificate. From now on, I am part of the covenant people of God. Your God will be my God. Not the old family God that I worship. Not Chemosh, the God of the Moabites. I don't care what my family worshipped as I was growing up. I belong to Yahweh. He is my God. Where you die, I will be buried. It doesn't matter where I came from. It doesn't matter where I was born or where I grew up and the town I grew up in. I want my bones to rest in Israel with God's people. This is a radical change of identity. It's an identity that is defined by Yahweh, defined by God. We kind of struggle to understand that, don't we? We don't tend to tie our identity to our land, or to our God, or to our family networks. It's not the base level of who we are. We are, if anything, individuals, self-made people. And we struggle to understand. But these people had a strong sense that who they were, their identity was defined by where they came from, and their ethnicity, and the family they grew up in, and most of all, the God that they followed. Ruth has turned her back on all that she was and declaring that she now belongs to Yahweh. She has a new identity from him. Let me read you a quote. "A decision to enter a new community which is what Ruth is doing, will entail a change in religious identity, and a redirection of religious devotion will result in a change of ethnicity. Ruth's speech, therefore, has radical implications. If ethnic identity can be changed by a turning or religious devotion, the Moabites and all others may become members of the covenant community by such a turning. And if this is the case, membership in the covenant community cannot be defined by genealogies or kinship networks, but rather by a decision to devote oneself to Yahweh and to Yahweh's people. This is what she is signing up for. We need to remember that conversion is just that. It's a conversion. It's a turning away from everything that we were and a turning to something new defined by God. A complete turning from who we were, a new identity. And what is even more spectacular, what was even more spectacular than Ruth's conversion, her buying into what God is doing, her commitment to follow God and have an identity based on Him, what is even more spectacular is that she does it after Naomi has said, "This God has dealt with me bitterly and turned His hand against me." She trusts this God even in the middle of darkness. Ruth also lost her husband. Ruth also lost her security and her provision for the present and for the future. And she is going to a land where she is an alien, a foreigner, and people may not accept her. And yet she commits herself to this God. Come what may, she commits herself to this God. Now, what I am not saying is that Ruth has faith and Naomi doesn't. Ruth has the faith to bind herself to this God, come what may, to pick up and take on a new identity defined by this God. Naomi has the faith to return home, even pouring out her complaint against God. Let's look at how that goes. Look at verse 19. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, and the whole town was stirred because of them, and the women exclaimed, "Can this be Naomi?" "Don't call me Naomi," she told them. "Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." Don't call me Naomi. Naomi means pleasant. Mara means bitter. Don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara, because God has made my life bitter. What would you say? What would you say to Naomi? She's sitting here pouring out her complaint against God. What do you say to Naomi? "Well, it's your own fault, Naomi. You know, you should never have gone to Moab in the first place. If you had been more faithful, this would never have happened to you. So, you know, you got what you deserved." It's neat, isn't it? Because if it's a punishment, then we don't have to deal with the troubling thing of what is God doing in this situation. Well, if it's Naomi's fault, God's off the hook. It raises questions for us, doesn't it? Seeing someone else afflicted and in pain, crying out against God. "Oh, no, Naomi, no, 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 Naomi, no, God would never do that. God only does nice things. God only does good things." We like, don't we? We like that God ended the famine. Isn't that nice? There was a famine, and then God intervened, and God ended the famine. We like that. We're not so comfortable with the idea that God actually brought a famine. That God is in control of the seasons and the days and the times and brought a famine. We're not so comfortable with that. We're a little bit one-sided, a bit one-eyed in how we see the world, how we see God's control, how we see God's providence. Do you have the faith to hear the lament of a person in pain? To hear the lament of a person who is crying out against God? Have you got the faith to sit and listen to that? Because it's important. We cannot silence those voices. As much as it makes us uncomfortable, as much as it raises questions for our own faith. And if you think about it, it's at the center of our faith, isn't it? Jesus was a man of sorrows, afflicted by God, familiar with suffering. When Jesus cries out on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? That was not a lack of faith, was it? That was faith, wasn't it? Jesus crying out on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? At the center of our faith, at the center of our faith is the idea that God's kindness, God's forgiveness, God's provision comes to us through suffering and agony. God enters into our suffering, into our agony. And the way of forgiveness, the way of peace, the way of grace to us comes through suffering. We have a tension that we need to live with. To refuse the nice, neat answers of why God allows what he does. Sometimes we do not know. Sometimes we do not know. And we mustn't, we must never silence the voices that cry out to God or cry out against God. We are never to silence those voices. If you read your scriptures, you will find those voices. God has given us words to address him in lament. If we silence those voices, we say that God has nothing to do with our suffering, or nothing to do with our pain, or nothing to do with our agony. And yet Jesus shows us otherwise, doesn't he? For now, we're going to leave Naomi here. And isn't that uncomfortable? We'd like a nice, neat resolution by the end of the chapter, wouldn't we? We'd like to kind of go, okay, I can deal with the pain, but mate, could you just kind of clean it up a bit at the end of the chapter so we can leave feeling good about ourselves and feel that the world's... That's not how this story works. That's not how any good story works, and it's not how life works. Because what Ruth chapter 1 does is it raises for us a bunch of questions. What is going to become of Naomi? What is going to become of her? What is her future? What is God going to do about this woman's pain, about this woman's situation? What is God going to do? What do we make of her crying out against God like this? But there is given to us a glimpse of hope, just a glimpse on the horizon. Verse 22. So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. We start with refugees, hungry refugees fleeing from their homeland, moving to another country because of famine. But we finish with them returning home. Naomi returns home. We start with husbands and with sons, and we return with a daughter-in-law of incredible character, of incredible worth. You watch the worth of Ruth throughout these chapters. We start with famine, and yet we return when? At the start of the barley harvest. Let's pray.